So, Ellie, it's really good to be speaking with you. Now, I obviously know what you've been up to and a little bit about your life story. But for everyone listening, would you like to talk a little bit about how we know each other and what you've done since leaving Wellington in 2011?
Yes, 2010, actually, 10 years ago.
Goodness, wow.
Yeah, so I was at Wellington 2006 to 10, and in the Cumbermere, which had just become a girl's house from 2007 to 10. Yeah, so I graduated 2010, then I spent a few years in St Andrews doing my undergrad degree in languages, spent some time abroad during that, and then afterwards moved to Japan for a year to teach. Since then, I did the kind of slightly lost 20-somethings back in London, trying out every job under the sun before I went and did a master's degree. Tried to set up my own business before a pandemic hit, and plans have changed slightly since then, and here we are.
Wow, quite a journey and quite an exciting one as well. Out of everything that you've done since leaving Wellington, what's the one bit you've enjoyed the most?
I think probably time spent living abroad. As we might come on to later, I really love having my freedom and independence, and those times where I've just been on my own on the other side of the world have been really freeing and a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the opportunity to try lots of different things, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Recently, you and your mum took part in the Listening Project, which is a Radio 4 initiative. And the idea of the programme is to kind of capture the aims, isn't it, of intimate conversations and build a picture of life today. And you sent me the link to that broadcast. And that's why we're chatting today, really, because it absolutely bowled me over, because for the first time, I really got an impression of what life had been like for you during that time that you were a student in the Cumbermere and I was your HM. I suppose I knew at the time there might have been something up at home, and I think your mum once told me that your dad was ill. But until I listened to the broadcast, I had no idea that your dad was an alcoholic and that you and your sister Jenny, who was also in the Cumbermere at that time, were living in really difficult circumstances. Would you just be willing to talk a little bit about what life was like for you then, and just explain to everyone listening what the sorts of things you were going through?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I feel so bad because when I sent you that link, I assumed that you knew, I think, a lot more than you actually did. So I think it must have come as a shock. But so when my sister and I were sent to Wellington in 2006, it was actually my mother's decision due to an escalating abusive situation in our family home. I didn't know that was the reason that we were sent there until about 3 years ago, just after my dad died and kind of everything came out. But yeah, home life was quite tough back then. Not that I necessarily realized at the time that things were as bad as they were. It was just a case of things having become so normalized and a question of surviving it that you just got your head down and got on with things. But yeah, so my dad was an abusive alcoholic. There were certainly instances of violence at home. I would say, though, that the main thing that we were dealing with was kind of 95% coercive control, psychological and emotional abuse. So kind of the constant threat of violence and, you know, the financial control of our lives. Every kind of action we did was really tightly controlled. And it's really hard to explain to anyone who's not been in this situation, because none of it sounds rational or possible or logical, but that's part of it. And it's the other thing that's difficult to explain is the relentless nature of it. It really is 24/7 that you were kind of under this like strict regime of control. And if you put a toe out of line, life is just absolutely miserable for you. So that's kind of what we were living with throughout school. And school was amazing because just being not under the same roof for most of your time makes an enormous difference, and is so helpful. And especially to my mum as well, because I know she was struggling coping with having two children being brought up in quite a dangerous environment. Yeah, school was amazing. School was a haven. It allowed us to be ourselves, to thrive, to actually like be seen as like having value and useful and being praised. But going back at the weekends and the holidays were always tough. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that, you know, the lead up came to those times of holidays. Did you used to feel a raised sense of anxiety about having to go home?
Yeah, totally. I flicked through some of my old diaries a while back and there were entries in there and the approach to the holidays just kind of saying, I can't bear going home. It's going to be awful, which invariably it was quite awful. And I think even on Saturdays every week in class, I probably didn't recognize it at the time, but would feel quite on edge and quite anxious. Mm-hmm. And I certainly remember a couple of times teachers picking up on a Saturday morning and kind of saying, are you all right? Just because I knew that it was only 24 hours back at home, but it wasn't going to be a nice 24 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh. I think when I listened to it, and then I wrote to you afterwards, my initial response, and I really, I don't know, I don't like myself for the initial response really that I had was one of huge guilt on my part, that I just had absolutely no idea of what you were going through at home. You know, you, your sister, your mum, you know, no wonder it was such a haven for you. And gosh, I just wish I could have done more to help you. And reflecting back on it, I think there were things that I certainly picked up on, particularly when your dad maybe came to a social event, although he didn't come to very many house events. You know, I just couldn't help thinking that I could have been a better HM and that I could have helped you more. And as you know, as I said to you, the first thing I wanted to do when I heard that was just say sorry.
No, and that, honestly, that's the last thing you should feel. And that's why I feel so awful for having sent it to you like that with no context. Just because I assumed that you knew, I always thought that mum had told you. But I don't think anyone in my life, family, friends, teachers at school, should feel guilty. It's such a difficult thing to spot. And particularly back then, this was like, 2006 to 2010, there was no real framework for reference for how bad this was. The law on coercive control only came in 2015. So, yeah. You know, that meant that me and my sister and my mum weren't even really able to recognise what it was or that it was wrong. So it's so then hard for everyone else in your life to appreciate that you're really going through something because you just think it's normal and fine. And especially we were pretty good at hiding it. Not really intentionally, just because there's a certain stigma around alcoholism. There's a certain stigma around abuse and violence. And frankly, also, when we were at school, we just wanted to feel safe and comfortable and happy, which we were. And there's, in the sense of survival, there's only so much you can kind of admit to yourself.
Yeah.
And I always think that if we had said it out loud, and really like put the banners up saying we are being abused, things are awful, it would have meant having to deal with it. And I'm not really sure how we would have done that. So the last thing I want is for anyone to feel guilty because it's really, really not anyone else's fault.
And how much did your friends know, Ellie? Because you had a very, very close group of friends in the Cumbermere. And actually all of you used to stay in at weekends and we used to have quite a lot of fun together at weekends when you were all there.
Yeah.
You know, how much, to what extent were they aware of what was going on?
Yeah, they were pretty aware. I never kind of thought I must never talk about this. I must fully hide this. So I always told my friends what was going on. But I think, again, when you're 16 to 18, you've got a lot going on in your own head, in your own life. And they were wonderfully supportive and so kind and always like let me talk and always looked after me. But I think when you're that age, you don't have the tools to like necessarily know what all of those things are and to report them when you like maybe should. So my friends definitely knew what was going on and were always there for me. Again, I think when you're that age, you just think like, oh, Ellie's dad is a bit difficult and he drinks too much. And that's where it kind of starts and ends. But no, my friends were great. And they were always really supportive, and they're one of the reasons that I like was able to get through it. And I'm still really close to them now. But I know that in sending you that link, I mean, I then felt bad also, because I think from what you said that brought up a few things from your own experiences as well.
Yeah, it did. I was, you know, one of the things which it really brought home to me was just actually in a very similar way, how you and I had actually been through a very, very similar childhood and upbringing. And the parallels really struck me, in that here was you going through something which I think that, you know, I had gone through at your age as well. You know, I did experience a very difficult upbringing, and actually I would say that even now I'm only just coming, you know, starting to come to terms with it. And I don't know about you, but I'd actually learned to block out quite significant parts of my life. I mean, I can barely remember anything that happened in my life up to about the age of 10. And the reason my situation was very different to yours. So it wasn't my dad, but I actually was at the end of some, you know, fairly difficult emotional and physical abuse from my mum. You know, and also that aspect of coercive control that you spoke about. You know, and my dad was at the end of this, you know, quite a complex web of deceit. And you know, and that was living with a parent who had quite a significant mental health disorder. Yeah. And like you, my dad got me out by sending me to boarding school. Yeah. You know, he made the decision aged 11 that I would be better off somewhere else, somewhere out of the family home, which was becoming ever increasingly more difficult. And I think he also recognised that as I was beginning to grow up, it was becoming harder for me, because I was beginning to answer back a little bit and possibly, you know, beginning to forge my own path in life. I don't know if you found that your relationships became harder as you became, you know, got a greater sense of awareness of your situation, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I, a bit like you, was always the sayer and the one who fought back. I imagine much to my mum and sister's chagrin, because it definitely made things harder at home whenever I came home. Mm. And mum remembers specifically a few moments when I came home from living in Russia during uni, for example, where she thought, oh dear, Ellie's back, things are going to be harder. And not in like a, I don't find that hard to say, because I'm aware that that's what I was like, but I was certainly the one that would answer back and stir things up a little bit and not sit down, which is just who I am, but also like made things really hard, which I'm sure it did for you as well.
Yeah, it definitely did. I think the other parallel that I think that the thing that we both experienced was that fact that we had to do everything really well. I was always told that I could have done better. So if I came home having achieved 80% in an exam, you know, or having played hockey for the first 11, it was always, well, why didn't you get 100%? Why aren't you playing hockey for England? Was it the same for you?
Oh my gosh, absolutely the same. Yeah, it was. I don't think it was quite as explicit as that, but just there was never a well done from my dad, at least. There was never, and I'm proud of you. It was always a, you know, quite nasty stuff like, you're useless, you're doing nothing, which at the time I was aware was not true, because I was a pretty good student at school.
Yeah, you were. You were brilliant.
Glad
you worked incredibly hard, Ellie, and you were incredibly self-motivated, incredibly driven. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that part of that was the fact that you were so worried about the response you might get when you were going to go home?
Yeah, maybe subliminally. I think failure, I'm doing air quotes, in that sense, was never really an option in our household. My father was incredibly clever. I think it gets overused now, but the term genius is not an overstatement for him. He went to Oxford age 16 and had his PhD from there age 21. He was so bright. So the standards in our home were always just like a level up.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, yeah, it didn't occur to me that there was any other way to exist.
And isn't it extraordinary? I think, I asked you why you hadn't said anything to anybody, and I was the same. I never spoke a word about what was going on with me at home. To any of my teachers, to my housemistress, to sports coaches, to music teachers, all of whom I had an amazing relationship with. And the one reason why I didn't say anything was because I thought it was normal.
Yep. 100%. And strangely, even though I've done so much learning about it and know in my rational brain that it is not normal and not okay, there is still a part of me that thinks, oh, but everyone goes through that, don't they?
That absolutely. And I remember, one of the things that, or the memories that I have actually probably when I was about 8 or 9 years old was at a Sunday lunch at home. And I was served spotted dick and custard, which I just didn't like. I mean, it was horrible. And I remember my mum hitting me and sending me up to bed. And it must have been about 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. And there I stayed, and I wasn't allowed to come down for the rest of the day. And I was up there until the following morning, until I went to school. And I remember as that child just thinking, well, this is what happens to everybody when they don't want to eat their pudding. They get sent upstairs and ignored. And even when I went to sort of other people's houses, I still never really thought, gosh, life here is so different. I just thought, well, this is the other family just being nice whilst I'm here. And that sense of normalization, is extraordinary. And I think unless you're in a situation like you and I have been in, you don't fully appreciate how much you normalize things which are completely irrational.
Oh, totally. My sister and I still, 3 years on from my dad passing away, we still come across things where we'll call each other and just double check, like, is this behavior normal? Like a while back, she called me to say, hey, I've just discovered that asking permission for a shower is not normal. Which sounds wild. It's so irrational. But, when she said that to me, I was like, oh, right. Okay. Good to know. Because that's just how we lived. And if you had gone for a shower, heaven forbid, without asking permission before and getting permission, it was it was trouble. It was hell.
Yeah. Little things like that, that unless you've lived with them, other people would just really wouldn't understand, I guess. And I think, Has lockdown made you think about your upbringing as well? Because certainly for me, I've thought a lot about what life would have been like if we'd have been in lockdown when I was living at home and my dad was still there. Because there'd have been no escape. My dad's escape was going to work, playing golf, getting out in the garden. My escape was boarding school, and all of those things would have been taken away from both of us. And I've just thought, gosh, I have absolutely no idea how on earth I would have survived. And have you thought the same?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought about it really early on in lockdown, and even thinking about it, I don't know with you, it makes me feel physically unwell, just from imagining myself in that situation. Yeah, we had so many different escapes, as you know, boarding school, playing loads of cricket, my mum going out to work, even, just coming home for dinner and the night at home was a stressful enough experience. So I cannot imagine what lockdown would have been like with my dad. It would have been absolutely unbearable and things would have gone really south, I'm sure.
Yeah, and a lot has been written, hasn't it, in the press about how you know, families living with domestic abuse or domestic violence have struggled during lockdown because that there is no escape. And also other sources of support as well have disappeared.
Yeah. It's so important in those situations to have people that you can go out and see and lean on and not losing contact with your family. And I can totally see how lockdown would regulate that, especially in terms of talking to people. One of the other weird little things that we did that I didn't realize was strange until afterwards is that we had kind of a code language over text for things we needed to talk about without dad. So my mum would send me a little text with the right code to mean that she was going to go out, steal 10 minutes to be able to call me and talk about things we needed to talk about. And that just would not have been possible with any form of lockdown.
Yeah. And that sense, yeah, I mean, and the pressure really that would build up would have been quite extraordinary. Mm. You know, the other thing that I mentioned to you was that whilst boarding school was a really safe haven for me, the staff there I found as well almost filled gaps for me as well. So, you know, particularly influential teachers like my sports teachers, like my music teachers, I really did look to them, you know, to be guiding me and to and you know, looking back now, they're still hugely influential on me. And I still keep in touch, particularly with two teachers who showed so much kindness to me when I was at school. You know, I still regularly meet them, and I think I'll just be forever indebted to them for just being there and helping me through something they had no idea I was going through, but just a kind word or something that they did meant so much to me.
Mm. Well, it's funny, the fact that you felt guilty when I sent you that link, hearing about it all, because that's exactly how I feel about you. Like that, and that's why I assumed that you knew, just because you handled everything with so much care and you showed us so much love and support, that I just kind of thought, oh, she knows what's going on at home. She knows how difficult things are. So this is why she's able to provide such a supportive, wonderful environment. And you really allowed us to be who we were, to flourish doing the things we loved. And you always showed us that we had value when perhaps we weren't being shown that at home.
Gosh, wow, Ellie, that's that's really humbling for me to hear. In many ways, perhaps not knowing enabled that relationship to be really free flowing without any underlying sense of I don't know how to express it really, because you wouldn't have felt that I was doing it because I had to, I suppose.
Yeah. It felt more natural that way, that there perhaps wasn't a constant surveillance of how we were doing.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, that I've got a vivid memory actually. My I remember being in school. I never used to go home at the weekends. I didn't want to go home, and used to be one of a handful left at school at the weekends. And I remember my music teacher and his wife inviting me round for supper on a Saturday evening. Mm-hmm. And it meant so much to me. I can still actually remember exactly what we had as a starter, main course, the pudding, because I was blown away by the fact that somebody could be so kind and letting me into their house and share in such a lovely meal. It's just incredible, isn't it, what you can remember. And you know, what do you think staff at Wellington or any boarding school can learn from your experience and how they might reach out to young people?
It's really hard. I think it's easier now that there's a framework for reference. So I would say that all staff just need to know the signs of what coercive control is, because someone in it might not know them and might not know it's wrong. I think just being really, really attuned to the little things.
Yeah.
And I can definitely pinpoint a few separate moments during my time at school where, like you say, when maybe my dad had been around for a parents' evening or something, and teachers kind of saying to me afterwards, you know, is everything okay? Your dad seemed very unimpressed with everything, and we sang your praises for like 10 minutes straight. And a few different teachers picked up on things and said, is everything all right? So I think, in as much as you can, I know there's safeguarding stuff around this, but talking to other teachers, keeping an eye when, you know, a student is perhaps behaving a bit out of character, asking gentle questions. I think I was never consciously trying to hide everything. And if someone had asked the right questions, it would have all come spilling out. But because my first answer was always, oh, no, everything's fine. I'm fine.
Yeah.
But if someone had said, you know, did something go on this weekend? I would have been like, oh, well, yeah. So I think just really keeping your eyes and ears open, picking up on the little things, if possible, sharing things with other staff members, because definitely if a few heads had come together with my situation, I think people probably would have realized, or at least a little more realized. And then I would just say being kind, like you, I really remember those moments of kindness, like almost detail for detail. But also I really remember moments where teachers were perhaps having a bad day and weren't so kind to me, because I was facing that level of constant abuse at home of, you're useless, you're worthless. If a teacher, you know, had a frustrating day with another student who had been annoying them and then turned around and said something slightly harsh to me, I really took that to heart, because...
Yeah, you know, Ellie, I was the same as well. It cuts through you, doesn't it? Like a knife. You know, I felt the same, and I felt that if I'd done something to upset one of my teachers, the guilt that I used to feel, and that sense of, oh gosh, you know, it's happening at home. I, you know, everyone thinks I'm rubbish at home, and now they think that I'm really awful at school as well. I mean, it was an absolute catastrophe for me if something like that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I remember one teacher one morning saying to me, like after class, are you okay? You just seemed a bit tired this morning, or a bit upset. And I think probably it was a Saturday morning. And I said, no, like, I'm fine. And the teacher had said to me, oh, I was just a bit worried that my class was a bit boring this morning. I was like, no, not at all. And then I remember for the rest of the day, even though that was such a tiny thing, thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so horrible. That poor teacher has thought that their lesson was rubbish because of me. I should have been more awake. I should have been more alert. And it's just the tiny, tiny things that can really, really get you.
And I think what you've really brought out there, Ellie, as well, is that blaming yourself for everything.
Yeah.
You know, you know, and I still, I don't know about you and whether it's had a longer lasting impact or legacy on you, but I always feel that whenever anybody says anything to me, which might be, you know, slightly critical or even just an observation, my immediate response is, what have I done wrong?
Yeah. I've been working on it really hard, and I'm fortunate enough that, well, fortunate in a way, but I have the space to now because, you know, my dad is sadly gone, but so I've been able to stop and work on that stuff. But yeah, my immediate response to stuff is like, okay, so what have I done in this situation? Yeah. Which sometimes is healthy, because a lot of people don't do that. And a lot of people put the blame onto other people and never look at things internally. But I think I assess internally to almost a detrimental point.
It is, and it is really important to work through stuff, isn't it, Ellie? I mean, I've had counselling to try and come to terms a little bit with what happened to me, and even now, still how I deal with certain things. You know, that I've got a complete tendency towards wanting to get everything 100% right, even though it doesn't even matter anymore. You know, my mum is still alive, but is suffering from dementia. So she's still there. She doesn't really have a sense of what's going on. But even now, I haven't got to please her. And sadly, my dad did die a few years ago. But I still feel that element of having to please, because it's so ingrained into you, after, isn't it? After having lived in that situation for the best part of 18 years.
Yeah, totally. And I think actually, funnily enough, I went a bit the other way with it, whereby I know my sister took away a real fear of confrontation and just, you know, putting her head down and making sure she was pleasing everyone. Whilst I do quite a lot of introspection of what have I done wrong, I also have slightly gone the other way, whereby because we had so much of it at home, I'm quite comfortable with confrontation. And if, you know, someone is being a bully or being rude, I'm quite comfortable confronting someone and quite comfortable not pleasing everyone, which is equally sometimes not a very popular way to be.
I remember you being not confrontational, but one of the things I've really admired about you is your willingness to actually speak your mind and actually forge your own path in many ways. Because I know that, like many young people that have grown up with an alcoholic, I know that you don't drink, and you went off to university and you spent your sixth form years at Wellington not drinking any alcohol. And that's a really hard thing to do when you've got that peer pressure all around you as well.
Yeah, it's funny. People still say stuff to me like, wow, how do you do that? It's so difficult. Can you give me tips? But I'd never wanted to do it. I'd seen the really awful side of it. It didn't appeal to me. And I was also aware from quite a young age that such things are hereditary, and I just was not willing to risk it. But yeah, there was certainly a lot of peer pressure. I mean, even now, people don't like the fact that I don't drink. People think that I'm judging them by them drinking and me not. So yeah, it's a bit of a constant battle, but I just never felt inclined to. I always felt really put off by it, and like you say, I've always been quite headstrong, so it was never really a problem for me just to put my foot down and say nope, not interested.
You've talked about so that's one aspect of how it shaped your life. You've also talked about valuing your freedom. What else would you say, how else would you say it shaped, you know, where you're at now or how you live your life in a positive way?
Yeah, well, I think there's loads of positives from it. As with all kinds of suffering to any degree, it makes you a lot stronger. I think from it, I've got wonderful friendships. I'm lucky now in that my family relationships are starting to develop, but for a long time, I didn't really understand the whole family is everything thing. So for me, my friendships were always my family, so I've got really, really great friends from that. I think, like we've said, I'm very confident in who I am. I have my own thoughts and opinions, and I'm never scared to express those. And yeah, like we've said, I really value my freedom and independence more than anything else in my life, which I see as a really good thing.
Yeah, I'm very similar, Ellie. I mean, you know that I love running and swimming, and I don't actually see that in many ways as going out and getting fit or training for a specific event. But what I see it as is just that, still a sense of freedom of being able to get out on my own because I can.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things for me now that I've got my own daughter is actually also making sure that she's in a completely different environment. That always thinking about how important that sense of value is, and actually being praised authentically, and just really making sure that she feels loved. I think that's certainly, and I think actually I probably started to come to terms with my childhood after I'd had my daughter, because I think it just throws up so many different memories for you.
Yeah.
Gosh, well, we could talk all day, Ellie, couldn't we?
Yeah, we really could.
we thought we would do this because we felt it was really important, didn't we, for people to listen to our stories and maybe have our own listening conversation in case we could make a difference to somebody else, didn't we?
Definitely. And I think we're both lucky in a sense that we're out of those situations now, able and willing to talk about it. And it's a really important conversation to be had, because I think a lot of people don't really know what this kind of abuse is and how it functions.
Yeah. And actually going back to what we've said all the way through this is normalizing things which aren't normal.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think if us talking about it, you know, wakes anyone up to their own situation or to a friend's situation, then I think that's so important, so people can go off and educate themselves, figure out how to be a good support network, all of that.
Definitely. And in this sense of semi-lockdown, I know that you're in London at the moment. What does the rest of the day hold for you today?
Very little. I might brave going out for a walk to the park, which is quite an experience in London at the moment.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me. Take care, and I'll see you soon.
You too. See you soon. Thank you.
Thanks.